is better than Elm Street.
Did not mean to let that piece run so long. I've got business going on, writing stuff, and hey, how are you? 10th day of January. You know, I came across a statement a while back. As you'll wonder where the yellow went when you trust this effing president. But that's not going to be our subject for the day. Jeff Bennett here. Edge of darkness. Or is it the edge of the nation going broke? I start looking at headlines. And we published a fair amount this morning. Actually quite late last night. Today's jobs report signals a recession is coming in 2023. The problem is, when you begin to read the article, it talks about job openings remain high across the triangle and across the United States, leading to better than expected hiring across the U.S. economy. But there's also bad news in this positive. The Federal Reserve will likely keep raising interest rates, which means a recession. Demand for labor is so strong, despite the fact that everybody's talking about a recession. Companies are talking about a recession. And companies are cutting people left and right. I sometimes wonder what the hell these authors are reading. It's just shocking to me. But then you take a look at, you know, the next one, which is not economic related, although Big Pharma will turn it into such. The next pandemic is coming. Yeah, well, it's plandemic, and of course that could be any number of things. Johns Hopkins Center for Health and Security, in collaboration with WHO, World Health Organization, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, conducted something called the Catastrophic Contagion Pandemic Exercise this past October at the annual Grand Challenges meeting in Brussels, Belgium. The group of participants included 10 current and former health ministers, senior public health officials from Senegal, Rwanda, Nigeria, Angola, Liberia, Singapore, India, and Germany, and let's not forget Bill Gates himself. The exercise simulated a series of meetings of the WHO Emergency Health Advisory Board, focusing on a fictional pandemic in the near future. Near future, participants grappled with how to respond to an epidemic that spreads in one part of the world and becomes a plandemic with a higher mortality rate than COVID-19, disproportionately affecting children and adolescents. Come on, people. The goal is to cut the population of the earth. Don't kid yourself. But in this case, participants were challenged to make urgent policy decisions with limited information in the face of uncertainty. Each program and decision had serious health, economic, and social implications. And I've a thought on all of this. We could avoid any such horrific outbreak very easily. Let's first of all quarantine all the psychopath participants for their own safety, of course, and never let them out again. They'll be just fine. They can live in the metaverse, dining on bugs and plastic meat. I like that one. Makes sense, doesn't it? You know, I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday talking about a new pickup truck that Ford Motor Company has out. I'm trying to think of the last or one of the Ford pickup trucks I owned. It was a small one, a little four passenger job, not a big one. I used it for painting. I can't remember the name brand on it. But they've come up with a new one that apparently is a subversion of that truck's modern version. And they've named it Maverick. Now, you remember years ago, they had a car called Maverick. They've decided to use that same name for this new truck. Small truck. Front wheel drive, I guess. 44. $1,000. Are you out of your freaking mind? We take a look at what in the living hell took place with U.S. auto sales last year. Believe it or not, it was lower than it was in 1977. You start taking a look at the charts for General Motors and Toyota, Ford, Stellantis, whatever the heck that is. Hyundai, Kia, Honda, Nissan. It goes on and on and on. The thing about new vehicle sales in this country is that even in the good years, they're bad. And in bad years, they're simply terrible. Last year, total new vehicles delivered to retail customers and fleets dominated by rental fleets fell by 8% from the already terrible 2021. Only 13.7 million vehicles sold, below where deliveries had been in 1977, down 16.4% from the peak in 2016, and down almost 21% from the prior peak in the year 2000. 45 years of stagnation with steep plunges in between. But who in the hell can afford to fork out $44,000 for a little pickup truck? I mean, come on, folks. The way automakers have gotten their dollar revenues to rise over the decades in this environment of stagnating or plunging unit sales is to sell more expensive vehicles, going upscale, even fancier, more advanced, better performing, more efficient, better equipped, safer vehicles. Was it last year? I can't remember now. Maybe it was the year before. Yeah, it was. I had this Jeep that I had purchased. It was a piece of crap. And one day I got up and decided to go give it a bath. Drove out to a dealership that had a car for sale. I thought I'd go take a look at it. After having driven that Jeep for a couple of years, I got all my money back out of it. Of course, the prices were going up, you know. And I got there before my salesman did. And I don't even know how I met this salesman. No big deal. So, I got there before he did. And I called one of the managers and said, hey, I'm kind of interested. I saw this car advertised. Is it out here in the lot where I can look at it somewhere? And it wasn't out in front. And by the way, this is a Toyota dealership that didn't even have 8 brand new Toyotas to sell. Their new car lot was completely empty. They had a pseudo used car lot that might have had 30, 40 cars on it. That was it. So I meet the salesman. Anyway, the manager tells me to go take a look at the car. He says, yeah, it's probably parked out in back. I said, can I go back and take a look? He says, sure, go ahead. So I walked back there and I found the car. It had been taken in a trade. They had not serviced it yet. They hadn't cleaned it yet. Detailed it, nothing. The doors were unlocked. One of the windows was cracked open. And I took a look at the car. One owner car, pretty nice condition. High 70,000 miles, a 2013 car. That's pretty low mileage for a car of that age. And I cut the deal. Took them a couple days to get the car ready, but I don't think that they serviced it as well as they should have. But it's okay. So I bought it. I don't care for the car that much. 2013, it's a Hyundai Tucson. Pretty well loaded, nice moonroof and leather seats and all this stuff. It's got a little thing called Eco, which if you push, it's supposed to give you better gas mileage. It doesn't. In fact, I don't even like the way it drives it. The vehicle seems to work harder to try to get you to drive around. Well, I haven't put that many miles on it. I mean, you all know what I've been going through health-wise and how many times I've been in the hospital, in the ERs. I'm not driving it every single day. And took it in for service here 5 months ago or so. Found out my car had been put on a recall for a motor replacement. I got a brand new engine in that car. And the car had got, at that time, had maybe 81, 82,000 miles on it. Let's see how little I put on it. And I wound up with a brand new engine with a 100,000 mile warranty on it. Now, over the last 24 hours, I've had a couple of interesting situations when I went to start the car. I didn't like the way it started. I had to shut it off and restart it, and it didn't reactivate. So I got to take the car in. The point is, I don't even like the car that much. It's got the hardest damn seats I've ever sat in my life. It's not a particularly comfortable ride in that respect. It's marginal in size. It's not a super small one, but it's not a big one. I don't need a big SUV. I'm not driving that much stuff. I'm not hauling that much stuff around. My wife's got a 2016 car. It's got more miles than mine than this has on it. But my point is that at the time I bought it, we thought that we were going to get stuck having to put a brand new motor in or a replacement motor in a 2003 Nissan Pathfinder that I had. Now, I bought that Pathfinder probably 4 or 5 years ago. And when I bought it, it had 180-some-thousand miles on it. And it has been the most freaking reliable car I have ever owned. Well, turns out that we didn't need a new motor. It needed $17 worth of washers to take care of a minor issue. Took care of it. Car's still running. Our daughter's driving it. It's supposed to be a loan for a couple of days, and it's been God knows how long now. And she's got some dings in it and got a little dent in it in the back and this, that, and the other thing. But the damn car still runs solid as hell. All this computerized stuff drives me insane. And they're driving up the prices on this junk. At one point in time, I had that Pathfinder for sale for, I don't know, $3,500 or $4,500. Some guy offered me $3,500. I told him to stick it. Ultimately, God knows how much that car became worth. Don't care. It's insane. Automobile manufacturers can't get all the parts. The Ford Motor Company has shut down one of their plants that builds their electric trucks. It's all getting shifted to Mexico. Why do they do that? I mean, with all the Mexicans that are coming up here, they could just hire them to come on in, offer them cheaper money. It's insane. Enough of that conversation. I got much to do this day. Now, let's see what else we got. Federally insured crypto-focused Silvergate. It's a bank. Has lost 43% of its market value because their depositors are fleeing. Their stock has been plunging since April of last year. This crypto stuff is a nightmare. It is an absolute nightmare. And yet I know that ultimately that's what the government's going to be pushing for. Here's another one. Present monetary system is breaking down. Oh, surprise, surprise. Central bank policies curtail investors' ability to distinguish wealth-generating activities from non-wealth-generating ones. In other words, bubble activities. An increase in money supply masquerades as an increase in real wealth, all of which results in erroneous investment decisions. And hence, all other things being equal, the exchange value of assets is set by the pool of real savings. Changes in monetary liquidity because of central bank policies have caused disruptions known as bull bear markets. That's what you call them? I call them bullshit markets. You know what my favorite term is. But in the framework of market-selected money, such as gold, and in the absence of a central bank, an increase in assets purchasing power is going to reflect an increase in the pool of real savings and thus economic growth. Ha, ha, ha. It's crazy. Let me share this with you. I've got a fair amount more to go in this program tonight. I've got lots to cover. This is simple. It's kind of a short essay on sound monetary policy, appropriate to the topic at hand, of course. If a domestic money consists of a commodity, such as a pure gold standard or cowrie bead standard, the principles of monetary policy are very simple. There aren't any. The commodity money takes care of itself. Now think about this. Imagine that if we had sound money, we don't need the Fed. We damn sure don't need Congress. We just need sound money. End of essay. End of essay. I could turn that into something else. Economist Nouriel Roubini once attacked the gold standard. He said that Roubini raised the following question. He said, if you're on a gold standard or modified gold standard, what do you do in the event of a bank run? If you don't have enough gold to fully back the currency? Well, there's an interesting translation to that. What happens if the banks have created bogus IOUs for their depositors' gold? Suggestion is maybe have them indicted for fraud. Gold doesn't back anything. It's the money. The banks issue IOUs for the money. When they issue more IOUs than they have gold on hand, then they are cheating. In my view, issuing promises to pay on demand in excess of the amount of goods on hand, my friends, is simply fraud. And should be so considered by the legal system. This would be legalized counterfeiting. This would be the creation of money without the necessity of production to compete for resources against those who have produced. In short, I believe that fractional reserve banking is disastrous both for the morality and for the fundamental basis and institutions of the market economy. Think about all that. Interesting. Ludwig von Mises once stated that the gold standard requires nothing else than the government abstain from deliberately sabotaging it. What all the enemies of the gold standard spurn as its main vice is precisely the same thing that in the eyes of the advocates of the gold standard is its main virtue, namely its incompatibility with a policy of credit expansion. The nucleus of all the effusions of the anti-gold authors and politicians, that is the expansionist fallacy. You see, my friends, the gold standard removes the determination of cash-induced changes in purchasing power from the political arena. Its general acceptance requires the acknowledgement of the truth that one cannot make all people richer by printing money. The abhorrence of the gold standard is inspired by the superstition that omnipotent governments can create wealth out of little scraps of paper. Does that simplify it? I would certainly think so. More interesting headlines, which we're going to move through here very quickly now. Some more conversation about Bitcoin. The great Bitcoin debate, sound money or tulip mania? More war means more inflation. Keep that in mind. Advanced economies and emerging markets are increasingly engaged in necessary wars, some real, some metaphorical, all of which will lead to even larger deficits, more debt monetization, higher inflation on a persistent basis, and the future will be stagflationary. And the only question is, how bad will it be? We are also now waging a costly war against future pandemics. And for a variety of reasons, some of them related to climate change, disease outbreaks with the potential to become pandemics will become more frequent. Because that's how they control the people. They scare the crap out of us. And here we sit, keep sticking our nose in, dumping tens of trillions of dollars into Ukraine. And the United States just can't keep out of everyone else's damn business, can they? We talked about the massive losses of jobs, and the tech industry has become one of the central pillars of our economy. Tech stocks led the way up during the stock market boom, but now tech stocks have been crashing. Many of our biggest tech industry companies have been laying off large numbers of workers. And if the strongest sector of our economy continues to rapidly deteriorate in 2023, what will that mean for our weaker sectors? I think the answer to that question is obvious. The truth is that we're in for our bigger trouble than the experts realize. But most people still assume that everything will work out just fine somehow. But it won't. And so the question asked is, will the implosion of the tech industry bring down the entire U.S. economy? And that which we shared with you for this nearly first half hour, 20 minutes, because we had 6 minutes worth of music, are today's headlines. Doesn't it raise your eyebrows? Doesn't it make you wonder what in the hell is next? And I look back over some records, something I published in some years ago, on one of our economic websites, talking about gold as a deflation hedge. It specifically refers back to the 1930s in the United States. A guy named Nicholas Taleb, writing in The Black Swan, the impact of the highly improbable states that the inability to predict outliers implies the inability to predict the course of history. But we act as though we are able to predict historical events, or even worse, as if we are able to change the course of history. We produce 30-year projections of Social Security deficits and oil prices without realizing that we cannot even predict these for the next summer. And our cumulative prediction errors for political and economic events are so monstrous that every time I look at the empirical record, I've got to pinch myself to verify that I'm not dreaming. What is surprising, my friends, is not the magnitude of our forecast errors, but our absence of awareness of it. Think about this. Webster, we're talking about the dictionary, defines deflation as a contraction in the volume of available money and credit that results in a general decline in prices. Well, typically, deflation occurs in gold standard economies when the state is deprived of its ability to conduct bailouts and run deficits and print money. Characterized by high unemployment, bankruptcies, and government austerity measures and bank runs, a deflationary economic environment is often accompanied by a stock and a bond market collapse, general financial panic, an altogether unpleasant set of circumstances. The Great Depression of the 1930s served as a workable example of the degree to which gold protects its owners under deflationary circumstances. First, because the price of gold back then was fixed at $20.67 per ounce. It gained purchasing power as the general price level fell. By 1933, when the U.S. government raised the price of gold to $35 an ounce in an effort to reflate the economy through a formal devaluation of the dollar, gold gained even more purchasing power. And then Rosenfeld confiscated gold bullion by executive order in concert with that devaluation, but exempted rare and unusual gold coins, which later were defined by regulation simply as items minted before 1933. Well, it didn't. You couldn't just own a bunch of pre-1933 U.S. gold pieces. You had to have different dates, different denominations, different conditions. You had to own it in the form of a collection. And then it became non-confiscatable. And by and if you were caught with the goodies, you could get hit with a $10,000 fine and 10 years imprisonment. Most people who had it shut up about it. They never advertised it, never talked about it, never showed off to anybody. In the 1960s, my grandfather showed me what he had held on to. But by then, it was all perfectly legal to hang it. Look, by 20 years later, in 1954, the Congress got together and they passed a law, which was signed by Eisenhower, which exemplified any gold coins minted prior to 1933. Didn't matter what country they came from. I don't specialize in a lot of U.S. gold coins. I have access to them, of course, and I have the knowledge of them. I don't sell rare coins. I don't get people into grossly overpriced certified plastic encased PCGS, NGC, et cetera, et cetera. You got to have a lot of money to buy the high quality stuff. But we're getting away from what we're talking about here. So once the laws were revised and modified, only those citizens who owned gold coins at that time, dated before 1933, were able to reap the benefit of the higher fixed prices. But secondly, since gold acts as a standalone asset that is not someone else's liability, it functioned as an effective store of value before and after the 1929 stock market crash and the string of bank failures that followed in its wake. Those who either converted a portion of their capital to gold or withdrew their savings from the banking system in the form of gold coins before the crisis struck, these people weathered the breakdown. Excuse me, let me repeat that, because none of this has changed. Those who either converted a portion of their capital to gold bullion or withdrew their savings from the banking system in the form of gold coins before the crisis struck, they're the ones that weathered the breakdown. Wouldn't you rather be one of those kind the next time around? Because those who did not do that found themselves at the mercy of events when the stock market crashed and the banks closed their doors, many of which had already been bankrupted. But how gold might react in a deflation under today's fiat money system is a far more complicated scenario. Even in a fiat money system like the one we have today, the general price level would be falling by definition. Economists who make the deflationary argument that within the context of a fiat money usually see the analogy of the central bank as pushing on a string. I hope that's the string they hang with. If one wants to inflate, but no matter how hard it tries, the public refuses to borrow and spend. And if all of this sounds familiar, it should. Because this is precisely the situation in which the Federal Reserve finds itself in today. In the end, so goes the deflationist argument. The central bank fails in its efforts. The economy rolls over from recession to a full-blown deflationary depression, much like what happened during the 1930s. And so how the government treats gold under a deflationary scenario certainly is going to play heavily into its performance. If gold is subjected to price controls and restricted ownership as it was in the 1930s, it would likely perform as it did then. Its purchasing power would increase as the price level fell. And under such circumstances, the ownership of rare and unusual might once again come into play. Except for one problem, nobody's going to have the money to be buying rare and unusual. I just want as much goods in my hand as are internationally recognizable. And yet, if ownership is not restricted, all of this could turn out to be the best of all possible worlds for gold owners. Its purchasing power will increase as the price level falls. The price itself could rise as a result of increased demand from investors, hedging systemic risks and financial market instability. You know, this disinflationary period, which led up to and followed the financial market meltdown of 2008, serves as a good example of how the second scenario might unfold. The disinflationary economy is a close cousin to deflation. It's covered in life. Something to consider. It's common sense stuff. I don't give a rat's patoot what spot gold is, spot silver, because it's all BS. Spot is a figure that's used to, that Wall Street uses to buy and sell gold and silver on paper, contracts, ETFs. You contract for 10,000 ounces of silver. You're never going to get possession of that. You've acquired silver on a piece of paper, which is about as useful as a dollar when it all collapses. And so then we begin to take a look at the kind of stuff that's available to us. This past year has been interesting. Yes, I can still get Canadian maple leaves. I can get Austrian Vienna Philharmonics. I can get Australian kangaroos. Sometimes we can get Kruger ends. Sometimes we can get some other stuff. The supplier I used to work with that supplied me with this massive amount of international gold, I ceased doing business with him because he became a crook. We started playing games with your money. And I didn't like that. And I said, when I place an order, I expect it to be shipped. Or if I sell you a product that a client's wanting to sell, I expect you to send me the money so I can wire the client. And they stopped doing all that stuff. They started playing games. If you go to our website, Sierra Madre Precious Metals, and if you're an RBN listener, and you're listening online, if you're listening through their website, Republic Broadcasting Network's website, over on the right-hand side, you'll see a painting of Humphrey Bogart from the movie The Treasure of Sierra Madre. Click on it. You want to go to the treasure chest. I keep it updated as much as I can. There is a particular gold piece that I have been doing so much with, it's unbelievable. It is a 1 ounce gold bar. But it breaks into 1/10 ounce pieces. You find, okay, I was just notified. If you're on your mobile phone, all you got to do is scroll down to find Humphrey Bogart on the home page. And you'll be able to take you to this page on Sierra Madre Precious Metals. So here's this little bar that breaks into 1/10 ounce pieces. Let me share something with you. If you wanted to go out and buy, and I happen to like small pieces, they're barterable, they're tradable, they're controllable. Yes, they're going to cost you a little bit more per ounce than if you were to buy a Maple Leaf or a Krugerrand or certainly an American Eagle. But they're barterable, they're tradable. You are going to be in control. It's not to say don't still own some full 1 ounce pieces that aren't breakable. Nothing wrong with that. And a lot of you have got that kind of stuff. But the breakable bars, my God. It is the most phenomenal piece. I'll tell you what, it has been the majority of what I have sold for the last 6 months. It makes sense to people. So if you were to go out and buy 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagles, I'm going to give you a rough figure right now. 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagles are probably going to run you somewhere between $75 and $80 more per 1/10 ounce than if you buy this bar that we're selling. And each bar, number one, they're pure. They're 4/9 fine. They're clearly marked 1/10 ounce fine gold. They break clean. They don't leave dust. They don't break and leave little particles all over the place, costing you money. Why would I pay $80 more? That means for, if you decided to buy 10 1 ounce gold American Eagles, it would cost you approximately $800 more than what you're going to pay for this Valcombi Swiss Combi bar. This is one of the most highly innovative way to buy gold. It is a sheet, per se, of 10 stamped combi bars in an assay card. Each gold Valcombi bar weighs 1/10 of a troy ounce, is made with a purity of 4/9 fine gold. Combined, all the bars put together add up to a total of 1 troy ounce. And the advantage of buying these is that they are easily separated without losing any gold mass. I think it's one of the most amazing things you could consider buying. This particular product first arrived in stores in Europe in 2011. And then they were released in America a few years later. And inspired by the Swiss history of chocolate making, Valcombi Swiss struck the combi bars in a very similar fashion to a chocolate bar. Specifically, you can break off pieces because of the perforation struck into the original bar. Splitting up the bars can be done safely because of this amazing engineering without losing one bit of gold value. And you know what, guys? This thing's small enough to fit in your wallet. They're easy to store. They're easy to sell. They're easy to break and barter and trade. You can sell parts of a whole or all together as one piece. The obverse of each of these Valcombi combi bars displays the typical Valcombi Swiss design of gold bars. Their logos on the top left corner of each bar. Inscriptions include each bar's individual weight, the purity of the assayer's signature. And this fully assembled bar's reverse makes up a horizontal display of a 1 ounce Valcambi Swiss gold bar. And the backside bears the Valcambi Swiss logo, which is the name, the weight, the purity, the serial number, and the terminology Essayer Fendir. Founding Essayer. So a sheet's going to get you 10 of the 1/10 ounce Valcambi gold combi bars. Each bar includes the assayer's mark, the individual serial number, shipped in the original sealed assay card to validate its authenticity. Valcambi Swiss is one of the top Swiss refiners. I am always pleased to offer their products in our inventory. You can order these now. Currently, spot is not bouncing around a lot. There's maybe a $1 difference from what I calculated earlier today. Spot gold right now about 1880, 1881. Each one of these bars, these 1 ounce bars, that breaks into 1/10 ounce pieces, is going to run you $2,055 as the current market. Now, if you're purchasing less than 10 bars, there will be a flat $25 shipping fee. You order one bar, two bars, you're going to have a flat $25, not per bar, per order. But gee, Jeff, that's a lot of shipping. You know what? Other companies charge a higher price and include the shipping. I'm trying to let you know you can have it both ways. Depends on what it is you're attempting to accomplish. That's what I'm trying to do, is give you the option. There is another interesting option, by the way. Silver for the last year has been, year and a half has been a bastard. It's been an absolute bitch to acquire any decent amounts of silver and pay a decent price. Okay? Hang on a quick second here. Talking with one of my suppliers, he has got the ability to deliver some silver for us. Just as we were going on the air, I checked one of my emails, and one of my clients had gone ahead and placed an order for 200 ounces. Silver rounds. Under this circumstance, this supplier, I can't deal with a one-roll deal or a two-roll deal. It's going to be a five-roll deal minimum. It's going to be 100 ounces minimum. And that's $2,835 for the 100 ounces. That is a delivered price. Okay? Delivered price. So, I just saw a mark on here and said, what in the hell have I done? It was unrelated. Scared the heck out of me. So if you're looking for silver, take advantage of it. I can go locally. My local supplier, I can get smaller quantities. We're going to pay a higher price. You know, you're talking $2,835 per 100 ounces. That means you're paying $28.35 per ounce. But Bennett, silver's only, don't give me that. It doesn't matter. There is a market for a product that is very, very tough to come by. Silver right now is at $23.68. There was one form of silver a year and a half ago that it was a 1 ounce. At $44 an ounce. But it was an exceptionally, not that I get into the rare coin market, but it was an exceptionally rare offering that is very, very tough to come by. Very, very difficult to come by Mexican libertads in this country any longer. Very tough to get by in Mexico. The Mexicans are hanging on to the stuff. They're not letting go of it. Oh, I'm sure some of it's crossed the border with the illegales coming through Nogales. It's the usual nonsense. Oh, how do you get a hold of me to place an order? Well, you can do a couple things. You can call us later, not while I'm on the air, 602-799-8214, 602-799-8214. If you've got a cell phone, you want to send me a quick text. If we've not texted before, in some cases we've done business, but I've actually never assigned your name to your phone number in my cell phone. It just drives me up a wall after a while. You can also send me a text and say, hey, Jeff, it's so-and-so. It's Sammy Squinjeezy, or it's Mary Guanguzzi. And, yeah, I want to take advantage of the 100 ounces or 200 ounces or whatever it is you're looking to acquire of silver or the gold. But be prepared to move, because I need to get suppliers settled very rapidly. The longer they've got to wait for the money, the longer you may have to wait to get your goods. But talking to the supplier right now on these silver offerings, we're going to get them. I just don't want to go to my local guy right now. I mean, if you're coming and saying, Jeff, I can afford one or two rolls. We've got a listener at this network that does buy rolls for me. And he buys one order, one roll at a time as he can afford to. Also, if you're going to be at the website, Sierra Madre Precious Metals, on that page, the Sierra Madre Treasure Chest, if you go all the way down to the bottom, is my email address. You can send me an email at that kettlemoraineltd@cox.net address, and I will respond to you. These are crazy times. And I know economically a lot of people just can't do it. They're trying to put food on the table. They're trying to put grossly overpriced gas into their tank. They may in fact be trying to, Lord knows what, survive. Not an easy thing to do, is it? Huh? Not an easy thing to do, is it? So take advantage of this stuff. If you've been looking to pick up silver, I don't want to go to my local guy, because if I go to him, we're not going to be looking at $28.35. We're probably going to be looking at 31, maybe 32. That's the nature of the beast. I have to go out. I got to pick it up. I got to come back, package it, ship it out to you. So my local guy doesn't do it. But I'm having to pay out the price to get it. As I've told you, I spent more money with him last year buying silver from him that I could deliver than I had spent in the entire 30 years that I've done business with the man. And he's going to be retiring in the next 2 years. Well, the company will still be in business, but it's not his company anyway. I remember when he first got in the business. I remember who owned the company at that time. And we've come a long way together. We're very good friends. Not a bad thing to have when you're in the market, right? But, yeah, I'm afraid that if I were to go to him to buy right now, we'd probably be looking at $30, $31 per ounce. If you can afford the at least minimum 100 ounces, take advantage of it. If you want more than 100 ounces, that's still going to be your price. But, you know, 100 ounce minimum, and we've got access. We've got access to the Bell Combis. You want to mix and match. You say, Jeff, I want silver, or I also want Bell Combis. Can you get me 3 Bell Combis and 200 ounces of silver? Yes, we can do that. You'll be getting separate shipments because they'll be drop shipped from different suppliers. As I told a gentleman yesterday who lives in Phoenix, I'm not a coin shop. I don't inventory anything. We fulfill your orders as is needed. Now, you can email us to the website. You can also give me a call, 602-799-8214. You can also send me a text at that number if you want to talk. Don't call me at midnight. Not midnight my time or midnight your time. And sometimes it takes, you know, a few hours, or sometimes it takes a day for me to get back with some folks. I got a lot going on here right now. Now, very quickly, bring that music down just a little bit, Michael. And tomorrow, we have a very special cancer program we're going to be doing tomorrow. I do not want you to miss it. It's not for my benefit, it's for yours. Does that make sense? We're going to be talking about cancer symptoms, specifically as it relates to skin cancer. We're going to be talking about natural therapies. We're going to be talking about prevention. Do not miss us tomorrow, January the 11th. Hope we'll have the time. Thanks for being with us. Have a good evening. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Benn. Declare themselves poor, and most of us are not sure if we have too much, but we're taking our chances. Say, I sang 20 years and a day, but nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flame. It's hard to love, there's so much to hate. Hanging on to hope, when there is no hope to speak out. In the wounded skies above, say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time. Do-do-do-do. Do you think we have time? Do you? Do you think we have time? These are the days of the empty hand. Oh, we hold on to what you can. And charity, charity is the coat you wear twice a year, yeah, yeah. This is the year of the guilty man. Your television takes a stand, and you find that what was over there is over here. So you scream from behind your door, say what's mine is mine and not yours. I may have too much, but I'll take my chances. Say, I sang it 20 years and a day. There's nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flames. It's hard to love. Jesus has so much to hate. Hanging on to hope, there is no hope to speak out. In the wounded skies above, say it's much too late.
maybe we should all be praying for time.
Times like these, you can't depend on the government to keep you warm and fed, but you can depend on the Vermont Bun Baker to do just that. With the Vermont Bun Baker, you'll never be in a situation where you can't cook, bake, fry, boil water, or heat your home all at the same time. One of the most revolutionary cook stoves, wood stoves ever, the Vermont Bun Baker is available with or without soapstone veneer, a natural stone that retains heat and radiates it back into the room once the fire is out. A beautiful addition to your home, the Vermont Bun Baker has an efficiency rating well above 75% and qualifies for the wood stove tax credit. For more information, watch the Vermont Bun Baker on YouTube and live stream or visit us at www.vermontwoodstove.com. You can also reach us by calling 1-866-SOAPSTONE. Don't ever be hungry or cold because the power's gone out. With a Vermont Bun Baker, all you have to worry about is what's for dinner.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.